From supermarkets to farms, to our own home gardens and kitchens, we all participate in the mega industry that is food every day. But what do we know about this global network? With the threat of climate change and increasing commercialization of farming, how can we sustain our current system so we have access to fresh and healthy food long into the future? To help us answer that, I'm joined today on Open for Discussion by Dr. Alana Mann, Chair of the Department of Media and Communications and co-convener of the Sydney Environment Institute's Food, People, and the Planet Research Node. After a professional career in the media and the nonprofit sector, Alana turned her attention to research, where she now looks at how everyday citizens can get their voice heard on big problems such as food security and climate change. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Alana Mann.
It's a pleasure. Hi, Chris.
So can I begin by asking how you came to research food policy and global food security?
Well, it does seem an odd leap for some people to understand why a media and communications researcher would study food systems. But to me, it's quite a logical connection because food is a very political issue in the world today. And the importance of it grows with the threat of problems like climate change. So I've always been very interested in how we get important issues into the media and the role of media in a democratic food system.
Is the food system the way food goes from agriculture to commercial to our table? Is that essentially what it is?
That's exactly right. And one of the challenges is that the food system is so big from production to consumption. But as consumers or eaters, as I'd prefer to say, we really only see the end of the food chain. We see the consumption and the waste end. So we tend to focus on that. But all the way from pre to post harvest, transporting, distribution, there are issues that we need to address across the food chain to ensure we have more resilient food systems to cope with threats.
Now, you're part of a really exciting project, the Sydney Policy Lab, and this will be a new multidisciplinary initiative that will bring together researchers from across the university with government agencies, community groups, NGOs, and industry to explore Sydney city food policy. Could you tell us a little bit about what the grant is, what the project is, and what you're going to do?
Of course. This is such an exciting opportunity. The group of researchers who've collaborated with me and include people from government and international relations, agriculture, gender and cultural studies, and public health, and issues such as the food system. They have multiple causes, some of these problems, and obviously great complexity of actors involved, and the solutions need to come from all areas of knowledge. And policy is essential because it's all very well to talk about these issues, but until we can make people aware of the issues in the public sphere and then translate public opinion into legislation to address them, we're really limited in our power to affect real change.
Can I ask, what are you doing in Sydney City? What's the project in Sydney?
Well, it's very interesting to talk about food insecurity in an apparently affluent context like Sydney. But the City of Sydney has produced data that indicates that up to 7% of Sydneysiders are actually food insecure, which means they haven't been able to feed their family within the last year. Now, another very surprising statistic for a lot of people is the fact that the Food Bank report tells us that 500,000 Australians actually visit a food bank once a month.
500,000 Australians visit a food bank once a month?
Yeah. And wow. I think, you know, when you live in a city like Sydney, where we do have a housing affordability crisis, it's the perfect conditions for increase in household food insecurity. But we know very little about the detail and the lived experience of food insecurity in a developed economy. And the City of Sydney is really keen for us to help them to include those most affected by household food insecurity in policy making.
And that's sort of taking the wicked problem methodology and putting it into practice, which is to say that you can't solve the problem of food insecurity without talking to people who are food insecure and having them be part of the solution. That's brilliant. I love that. So, Alana, Australia has a long history of agricultural production. We're an agricultural nation. Do you see this shifting as we sort of go toward the modernization of food systems?
Australia has a very interesting history when it comes to food. We were a settler colony that was used for broad-scale agricultural production for export, really. And the rhetoric from government since settlement has grown around this almost a mythology. Australia, of course, has ridden on the sheep's back. Mind you, you might say we've been riding on coal's back for a long time recently. This also raises a lot of issues about the fact that there are really intricate and complex indigenous food systems that have been, in some cases, annihilated by settler practices. But there's a kind of a government discourse around Australia being the food bowl of Asia. This is a quite naive perspective. It denies the fact that we are surrounded by neighbours who have some of the most appalling hunger and malnutrition statistics in the world. East Timor, one of our closest neighbours, has a rate of child stunting of over 50%. So when we talk about being the food bowl of Asia, I think we need to think more about what that means. It's not just about growing the economy, but it might be more about making sure our neighbours are more resilient. Again, increasingly with the threats that are going to face the Asia-Pacific region, including extreme weather events and rising temperatures and rising sea levels. And that in a sense talks to what we call extraterritorial obligations in food law and governance, which is about making sure not only that you feed your own population and you make sure that everyone has access to healthy, affordable food at home, but also making sure that your trade practices don't negatively affect farmers and eaters in other countries.
If I can pick on the United States here for just a minute, there was an example of this when the United States was pushing ethanol in its petrol, and that ended up consuming an enormous amount of corn, which produces ethanol, and then the cascading effect of it was that it left almost a million people in Mexico deprived them of access to food because otherwise that corn would have been exported and it would have been used in things. So food systems and the trade practices and the how you treat your neighbor and all of these things seem really connected. Can I ask what it means if people are switching to meat-free diets? What role, if any, do you think meat plays in the food network?
I think that it is quite sort of a Western luxury to be able to think that your consumer preferences are actually going to affect the food system as well. When I say a Western luxury, that's actually the wrong way to put it, because I think a lot of pressure is put on eaters in our society, a lot of guilt about diets. When in reality, we're talking about a food system that's broken to such the extent that your individual diet in our context is not going to change the system. So I think that changing our eating practices to reflect a political consumerism is good in terms of our own mindfulness about the issues to do with the system, because we do know that meat takes a lot more water and grain to produce. At the same time, we need to acknowledge there's no one size fits all with this. When you talk about not eating meat, you do also ignore the fact that if you're in a nation in the global south where you don't have access to a wide range of vegetables and particularly pulses and legumes and things like that, the way you get your protein is from meat. So we can't really in good conscience promote veganism or even vegetarianism without taking into account that the village chicken is one of the most important things keeping people alive in Africa, for example, and the egg is the perfect hygienic food source packed full of protein for so many people. And every country and every community has very specific needs, and that includes culturally appropriate food too. We shouldn't be imposing our food ways on other nations, because look at how we respond when people try and do that to us.
That's a great point. listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that discusses research from a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff, a lecturer in public policy with a particular interest in sharks and the role of emotions in policymaking. Today, I'm talking the politics of food with Dr. Alana Mann. Can I ask, what can we do? Like, what, it seems like the story is a complicated one. There's a little bit of progress. There are a lot of challenges. If the global food system is detached from the individual, then what can we do as individuals, if anything?
I think that's a very important question that a lot of consumers or eaters, they fail to get that information. And this, again, is another sort of failure of the media in a way, because a lot of the problems are simplified and the solutions, again, buy into this agency of the consumer narrative. And that's where the consumer can push back, I think. Resist things like market concentration. Australia has the most concentrated grocery sector in the world. So 80% of our groceries come from the big three.
Wow.
But particularly the big two, Coleworth. So that is a real concern. So this is where it's very complex and it's really challenging for people with families, for example, to indulge in some of these very ethically appropriate food practices like visiting the farmer's market.
Exactly. I mean, organic food can be expensive. And, you know, for those people who just can't afford it for a family of five or who can't afford it for a family of one. And I'm wondering, what would you say to people who have to use a supermarket? Is there any way to be a responsible contributor to, you know, sustainable food systems and use a supermarket?
Of course. I think a really good strategy is to eat around the edges of the supermarket. We've all heard of the Gruen effect, which is all about the way that the supermarket is designed to take you through the aisles and make sure that you do a lot of impulse purchasing. Most of the fresh food and healthy food is around the fringes, if you think about it. So focusing on that, and also, of course, avoiding some of the obvious traps that supermarkets present to you, you know, supersizing, taking the two-for-one offer when it's a really unhealthy food product. These are the sorts of things that make us think that we have access to cheap food, but it also has a negative effect because it makes us sort of forget the value of food, and it also fills us up with empty calorific food. The third thing is, I don't think growing your own food is going to feed the world, because even though urban agriculture is a very trendy and quite vibrant topic at the moment, and we're certainly looking at it in terms of the city of Sydney, you know, how can you have more green spaces and grow more food in the city? Because you do hear these bizarre stories. You know, I read something the other day about a US report that said that kids thought that chocolate milk came from brown cows or something. Now, I shudder to think that Australian kids think that, but it's just another sign of the disconnection between the eater and the food producer in a developed economy that we really need to address, because people aren't getting it about the threat to our food system and the danger of having a global industrialized food system. It's not going to feed us in the future.
What are your thoughts about the organic movement? I mean, because just like free-range chickens and being attentive to livestock, the organic movement looks at itself as one of the potential solutions. Is it? Or should we be more skeptical?
That's a very good question. It's really interesting that 80% of the food that's produced in the global south comes from small-scale family farmers who are using organic methods and have been for centuries. What is a problem with organics is it's becoming co-opted by, again, the supermarkets. So if you look at the organic ranges in supermarkets, they're expanding. I don't think that they're necessarily, though, supporting the ethos of the organic food movement, which is more about this attention on who produces food, how, and for whose benefit. It's like our discussion in Australia about free range. I do a lot of research on food, and I can stand there looking at the egg section sometimes and go, where do you even start? It's a lot to think about. And that's where policy making is really important, because governments, I believe, should be making it easier for people to eat in a sustainable, healthy, affordable way.
Can I ask you to tell me a little bit more about your project and how it's going to impact the city of Sydney?
Specifically, the city would like our assistance to ensure that when we do create new apartment developments, for example, people in those precincts do have access to healthy, affordable food. Unfortunately, a lot of the urban and planning literature tells us that governments also expect the market to fix these sorts of issues. So they say it's kind of an if we build it, they will come attitude. That concerns me because it's not a deliberate policymaking process, and it's not really thinking about people's needs, and it's also supporting, again, a concentration of power in the grocery market. So food insecurity is not just about having access to the food, it's also being able to afford the food, it's having the transport to get to somewhere where you can buy food. If you don't live in a community where you can actually walk to the shops, that's when you become food insecure, especially if you're also struggling to pay your electricity bill.
Well, I think that's a really important point. Thank you so much for a really interesting and really important discussion, Dr. Alana Mann.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast. And if you'd like to know more about our research, be sure to visit our website, sydney.edu.au/news.
Enjoyed this podcast? We think you would love another from the University of Sydney, where University of Sydney academics gave talks in small bars across Sydney. Raising the Bar, available on SoundCloud or iTunes.